This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's controversial sit-lie ordinance affecting the state's homeless community faces an uncertain future in the legislature.
An Oregon state bill passed in the Senate seeking to expand medical marijuana access for sufferers of post-traumatic stress disorder.
And a local activist speaks about his hunger strike in solidarity with Guantanamo inmates as the closure of the controversial prison is further delayed.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 30th, 2013. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Today, an Oregon Legislature Budget Subcommittee on Education approved a $6.75 billion school fund. The budget proposal passed 5-1 and is contained within Senate Bill 5519. It is $1 billion more than the current budget, which ends on June 30th and would be allocated to the state's 197 school districts. The proposal represents $6.55 billion in actual cash after $200 million in savings from the newly revised public pension system. Democratic Representative Betty Comp of Woodburn, who co-chairs the budget subcommittee, said this is the first time in years proposed school funding has been increased by $1 billion. According to the Statesman Journal, Comp said, quote, "It is a moment to be thankful that our state and nation are in recovery and that we can start reinvesting in our schools." Republican Senator Fred Girard voted against the proposal. Girard stated he would rather reduce public pension costs further. The budget now needs to be approved by the full budget committee before it goes to both legislative houses for a vote.
The Oregon Senate passed a bill that would allow people with post-traumatic stress disorder to use medical marijuana as a form of treatment. Senators in support of the bill and those in opposition agreed that PTSD is a serious problem in Oregon. However, opinions differed on whether marijuana is an appropriate treatment option. Representative Greenlick claimed that there are few ways to effectively deal with PTSD.
The testimony in our committee and the Senate committee on this issue was overwhelming, that one after another of the medical people that treat PTSD say there is no legitimate treatment for it that actually works. I think our carrier made that point. And two, that it really, really helps people who use marijuana for PTSD when they can't find anything else to use.
While Representative Widener called for better regulation of medical marijuana cards, he said that he supports the bill because many of those who suffer from PTSD have nowhere to turn for help.
Right now, we have a system that is not regulated. But if anybody needs medical marijuana, this is a group of individuals that I think is fitting for. The people that are coming in, when you watch teenagers who have medical marijuana cards going into dispensaries and getting medical marijuana, I have a big problem with that. We need real doctors that start addressing these issues and start taking away cards from people who don't have them and giving them to people who need them.
Representative Thompson voted against the bill and expressed concern for the abuse of the substance.
I would argue that if we take this route, we're opening a door we ought not open. We can use the same line of reasoning to legalize the use of medical marijuana for the treatment of ADHD among teenagers. We can use the same argument to substantiate the treatment of a seasonal affective disorder, depression caused by winter clouds, and on down the line. If we are going to legalize medical marijuana one disease state at a time without a thorough scientific vetting, I think we're getting pretty far off in the weeds as a legislative body.
The bill ultimately passed the Senate and now goes to the House for a vote.
Oregon House Bill 2963, which would have removed the state's constitutional limit on local sidewalk rules, was removed from today's Senate agenda and appears to be dead. Sidewalk ordinances, also known as sit-lie laws, are used to combat panhandling. Portland's sit-lie ordinance, which prohibited sitting and lying on sidewalks during the daytime, was declared unconstitutional in 2009 by a Multnomah County Circuit Court judge. HB 2963 would have made city sidewalk ordinances constitutional and limit the state's power to preempt local laws. The bill unanimously passed a House committee and received only two dissenting votes on the floor. According to the Portland Mercury, the bill was removed from Oregon's Senate agenda due to concerns it wouldn't have enough votes to pass in the upper legislature. HB 2963 was championed by the Portland Business Alliance in an effort to reduce harassment for downtown shoppers. Earlier this month, Business Alliance spokesperson Megan Dorn told the Statesman Journal that Portland attracts aggressive panhandlers who intimidate customers and frustrate business owners. However, critics say sit-lie laws unfairly target the homeless. KBOO's Ren Green spoke with Israel Baer, the director of Street Roots, a local newspaper that advocates for homeless people.
A lot of different community groups came together to say that this bill wasn't the answer to improve people's quality of life on sidewalks and for people experiencing homelessness. The ACLU and the Oregon Law Center, Street Roots, and a range of other community groups worked really hard to detour the bill. In the end, it just wasn't the right time for the bill to pass, and I think that we have to go back to the drawing board and figure out ways to support people who are experiencing homelessness and poverty with housing and services.
Do you think sit-lie laws should be used at all?
Any kind of law that regulates a sidewalk has to be really thought through and worked through with a range of different community members. I think that the fear is that most laws like this apply and target people who are experiencing homelessness and poverty, and they don't institutionally or systemically really attack the problem of being able to house, you know, thousands of people that don't have a home. Street Roots looks forward to continuing to work with businesses in the Portland metropolitan area to be able to maintain healthy sidewalks, and we look forward to having conversations with other community groups, including the Portland Business Alliance, to figure out ways that we can tackle the issue of homelessness.
That was Israel Baer with Street Roots. I'm Ren Green for KBOO News.
State legislators weigh the potential of economic benefit as opposed to civil liberties as they attempt to merge two bills on regulating the use of drones. Dialogue involving how to blend Bill 2710 from the House with Bill 71 from the Senate suggests that manufacturers are looking to establish friendlier terminology for their products. The focus is on beneficial uses such as search and rescue rather than how law enforcement agencies might make use of such equipment. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with Trudy Cooper, who's a local member of Code Pink, about the technology and the need for definitive language on how such laws get written.
The states are in a position because the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, early, I guess it was in 2012, passed a law that permitted the police and first responders to right now use drones, and they don't provide any provisions for control of them, and there are safety concerns, there's human rights concerns, there's civil rights concerns. So it's pretty much left up to states and localities to define what their concerns are and to try to limit them. The House Bill 2710 is one type of about three kinds of state bills or legislation that attempts to regulate domestic drones. There's about 26 states that have pending legislation. There's one city that has, Charlottesville, Virginia, that has passed a resolution putting a moratorium on drones. So they range from controlling the use of drones to banning drones outright or limiting the extent to which information gathered by drones, in other words, surveillance information, can it be used in criminal prosecution? Can it be used at all? Does it need to be destroyed so it, you know, will only focus on a particular case? So it really covers a whole spectrum of possibilities depending on what the concerns are of the local people that are sponsoring the bills.
Do you believe warrants should be necessary if law enforcement is going to use them?
I think that that is actually the intent of the Oregon bill, and also the intent is to prevent them from carrying weapons and other anti-personnel devices, as they have worded it.
The manufacturers of these unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, are trying to distance themselves from the usage of the word drones. Any idea why that might be the case?
They're definitely trying to sanitize the terminology.
Are you aware of any opposition to these legislative packages being introduced at the state level?
Well, the drone manufacturers are very powerful lobbies in the drone aerospace industry, so they have been very successful in getting legislation passed that is in their favor, such as that which I referred to as taking place originally in 2012. So that's why it seems very unlikely that Congress, as opposed to state legislatures, are going to have as much of an interest in protecting civil liberties or even having safety concerns. So that's why it pretty much falls to the states. I'd like to comment on the direction that the country is going on drones. And in the context of what Obama is no longer calling the war on terror, but is using, I think the language he uses, we need to dismantle networks of extremists that threaten America. And in doing that, he reinvoked with slightly new language the language that I think we have heard since the beginning of Bush's so-called war on terror. And he claimed that this was a just war that should be waged by drones and that it was being waged, his words were, proportionally in self-defense and as a last resort. All evidence shows us it is not proportional. It's not anything that any of us would define as self-defense, and it is certainly not in a last resort. We have the regular vigil, peaceful acknowledgement of the victims of drone strikes that is in Pioneer Courthouse Square every Friday at noon. And we would like to encourage people to join us and talk to people so that we can continue to speak the truth, because we're not necessarily getting much of the truth through the mainstream media.
This is KBOO News, and I'm Robin Ryan.
Today, the Oregon Senate Education Committee passed a bill that would require schools display U.S. flags in every classroom. The bill would also require Oregon school districts to provide time each day for students to say the Pledge of Allegiance.
Let me give you a little background on how we arrived here. We had a situation of where a teenager, sophomore, I believe, in high school in Rogue River, city of Rogue River, had contacted us, and a couple of us, and said that his school principal refused to allow the students to give a Pledge of Allegiance. It was true. And so this individual, a nice young man, got a petition together and had 400 and some students sign the petition, plus he went to the school board, plus he went to the community, and lo and behold, today they recite the pledge, which is by law. Then we found out that in Southern Oregon we had a public charter school that refused not only to do the pledge, but they refused to even fly the flag on the flagpole outside the school. They didn't feel it was, they were part of this bill, which existing law, I guess that would be an arguable situation. It doesn't mention charter schools because this law was crafted before we had public charter schools. So we're here today to change the public charter school part. We're here today to get those little flags inside the classroom, which people say, well, that would cost something. Well, it won't, because you can go to the VFW, you can go to several organizations, and I see Senator Roblin's nodding his head because he's been in the education all of his life. and they will provide the flags for the classroom.
Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I will also be very brief. I've submitted written testimony. As you know, we've had some concerns about the underlying bill, but appreciate the introduction of the Dash 1, and I think that addresses our concerns. So I appreciate your consideration of those, and thanks for considering our position.
The amendment to the Flags in Classrooms bill ensures that children will not be required to pledge allegiance if they choose not to. The Education Committee also considered a bill that would prohibit schools from requiring students to wear radio frequency ID cards or tags if those tags are used for tracking the student's location. The bill will not prohibit the use of RFID tags, but will allow parents to opt out. Representative Lou Frederick, who represents North and Northeast Portland, spoke in favor of the bill.
The bill passed as introduced, passed the House unanimously. You've received in your materials a letter from Tech America, an industry advocacy group, advocating that you refrain from limiting their access to what they apparently see as a lucrative market in tracking school children. That is their job, protecting and expanding their markets. It is our job to protect our children and their rights to privacy and security as human beings. Our children's privacy and security should not be fair game whenever new technology combines with effective salesmanship. The introduced bill explicitly notes that it does not prohibit the use of these devices to track and locate property, but children are not property. They are human beings with rights, interests, and developmental needs of their own. I'm reminded of a passage, if you'll pardon me, from Beverly Cleary's Ramona Quimby, age 8. I don't know if you've read that or not. I hope parents still read it to their kids. She would have been one of my constituents if she was still living in that area there. She starts off with, "Daddy, what are you studying?" She says, "I'm studying the cognitive processes of children." "What does that mean?" "How kids think." Ramona did not like the sound of that subject at all. "Why are you studying that?" she demanded. "Some things should be private, and how children thought was one of them." She did not like the idea of grown-ups snooping around in thick books trying to find out. "Well, I don't think you should," said Ramona. "It's none of your business how kids think." My point is, what boundaries are we willing to breach if we are willing to use tracking devices to follow our children? Where will it stop? Will they become tracked college students, tracked adults? We all know how boundaries of personal autonomy and privacy are increasingly squishy for all of us. We should not allow our children to be tracked like property, like livestock, unless we're willing to have the same treatment for ourselves. And I'm frankly a little creeped out by the suggestion that this would be okay. We should not simply allow this technology to be used on children just because it exists. Is it really a good idea, for example, to take attendance without human contact, by voice or eye contact? Failure to pass this bill means that this momentous societal change will be driven by vendors, not by policymakers like us.
The RFID regulation bill will now go to the full House for a vote.
Tourism is on the upswing in Portland, with more than 8 million visitors setting foot in the Rose City in 2012. Those visitors spent $4 billion, but elected officials throughout the Portland metropolitan area have their eyes on big-ticket convention events and the big dollars that they will garner. Now, Portland's regional government is reviving a nascent plan to construct a Hyatt Hotel near the Oregon Convention Center, and it's asking the state for financial help getting the plan off the ground. The Portland Business Journal reported that metro officials rallied lawmakers to pitch in on construction costs for the 600-room hotel this week. Metro declined to disclose the amount it requested, but a Metro reporter told the Business Journal that it will seek $12 million in lottery-backed bonds. Initial cost projections are $180 to $200 million. The project has already secured $1 million in funding from Metro, $4 million from the Portland Development Commission, and $100 million in private investments. Up to $80 million in revenue bonds could also come from visitor taxes assessed on future Portland hotel guests. The convention hotel plan was originally proposed in 2009 as a publicly funded endeavor intended to boost Oregon Convention Center patronage, but the plan fell through during the recession. The project could create up to 1,000 temporary construction jobs and 400 to 500 permanent hospitality jobs.
On Tuesday, residents of the Triangle Lake area west of Eugene received the results of an Oregon Health Authority investigation into pesticide exposure in the region at a town hall meeting. Members of the group Standing Together to Outlaw Pesticides, or STOP, held an outside demonstration dressed in chemical suits and backpack-mounted pesticide sprayers. The OHA is investigating the spraying of clear-cut areas with pesticides from helicopters and the impacts of pesticide exposure to local residents, specifically 2,4-D and atrazine. The investigation began in 2010 after both chemicals were found in urine samples submitted by residents. In contrast, the general population's exposure rate is 25%. Despite evidence that urine pesticide levels spike in the days following helicopter applications, investigators have not drawn explicit connection between exposure and spraying of nearby clear-cut areas. The report also ignores new science about the detrimental effects of low-level exposure to relevant pesticides and herbicides and does not include air quality testing. The Environmental Protection Agency is developing air tests, but these won't be completed in the area until at least 2014.
Members of the Klamath Justice Coalition gathered today outside the offices of Senator Ron Wyden and Pacific Corp to call attention again to a pending congressional agreement to restore a valuable Northwest salmon habitat. The indigenous-led coalition has long pushed for the removal of dams along the Klamath River, where disputes over water allocation and environmental degradation have simmered for years. The 10.5 million-acre Klamath River Basin extends across Northern California and Southern Oregon. It is the West Coast's third largest producer of salmon and home to six federally recognized tribes, as well as several national wildlife refuges, parks, and forests. It's also home to four dams owned by Pacific Corp, one for water delivery and three for hydroelectric power. Communities along the river have long complained about dead fish, algae blooms, fishing closures, and irrigation shutoffs. In 2010, the Klamath River Tribes and Pacific Corp agreed to the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, a plan that would remove the dams and funnel $800 million into restoration. Now, the agreement must earn congressional approval. A committee hearing on management of the Klamath Water Basin is set for June 20th in Washington, D.C.
A Salem man was arrested today after claiming that he tried to blow up a sign. 50-year-old Leonard Burdick brought a pressure cooker into the State Teacher Standards and Practices Commission office, claiming it was a bomb. Burdick told employees at the commission that he had tried to blow up their sign because it contained a typo. According to the Associated Press, the misspelled sign is missing a D in the word "and." Commissioner Director Vicki Chamberlain said Burdick brought in the pressure cooker with wires sticking out of it, saying his bomb didn't work. Burdick took the cooker with him when Chamberlain asked him to leave. Police say they arrested Burdick for investigation of disorderly conduct. The Salem Police Department also wanted to make clear that the pressure cooker was not a bomb.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed at 6 by a special live broadcast from the 2013 Indigenous Experience Northwest. It will be an evening of art, music, and storytelling, and will focus on healing methods and the medicine within. At 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio, news, and views from a hip-hop perspective. The weather this evening will see an increased cloudiness and a low around 50 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly sunny with a high near 68 degrees.
The time is 5:28, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It's been nearly 50 years since poverty in America was a front burner issue on our nation's political agenda, and it's time to move it up again. Even as those at the top of our society have grown fabulously richer in the past decade, those in the economic middle have seen income stagnate and fall, opportunities decline, and poverty become not about someone else, but about them. Numbers that were not even imaginable half a century ago are now our cold reality. 50 million poor people, 51 million more who are near poor, almost 1 in 4 children under 5 years old living in poverty, and no sign of this mass decline decelerating. The face of American poverty, however, has changed somewhat. In the 60s, the poor had largely been born into it and were out of most people's sight, tucked away in backwater rural counties and isolated urban ghettos. This kind of poverty persists, but today's big jump in numbers comes from families that have been knocked down from a middle-class life, dismayed to find themselves among the long-term unemployed, grabbing at temporary low-paying jobs and buying meager groceries with food stamps. These are the new poor, but they also constitute a new demographic phenomenon, the suburban poor. Once the secure base of the middle class, suburbs have become the fastest-growing home of American poverty. Since 2000, the number of suburban poor has surged by 64%, twice the rate of urban poor. By 2011, America's suburbs held 3 million more poor people than were in our core cities. This is Jim Hightower saying American poverty is no longer about them, but us. To learn more about it in your area, check out a new Brookings Institution study called Confronting Suburban Poverty in America at www.brookings.edu.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
The Obama administration announced today that it is extending the current foreclosure prevention program. The Home Affordable Mortgage Program, or HAMP, was set to expire this year, but has been extended for 2 more years. HAMP began in 2009 and pays lenders and servicers from the Treasury Department's Financial Bailout Fund. Of the almost $30 billion in funds allocated to HAMP and other housing programs, the Treasury has only spent about $5 billion through March of this year. The funds provide for the renegotiation of loan terms for borrowers who can't make their current mortgage payments. When unveiled in 2009, it was estimated that HAMP would help 3 to 4 million homeowners avoid foreclosure. But so far, only about 1.1 million homeowners have benefited from the program. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew says extending the program for 2 more years will help prevent additional families having this problem.
When a fertilizer plant in West Texas exploded last month, it surprised many people in the community who had no idea that a potential toxic inferno lived next door. Across the country, hundreds of buildings like the West Texas fertilizer plants contain some type of ammonium nitrate. Under the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act, states are required to tell people where dangerous chemicals are stored and how much is present in their community. But fears of terrorism have made it difficult for homeowners to find out what chemicals are nearby. An investigation by the Associated Press found more than 120 facilities across the country are located near schools and elderly facilities, which would be impacted if the facilities caught fire. More than half a dozen states did not provide information to the Associated Press for their investigative report, while reporters had to request records in person at regulatory agencies in other states.
Letters containing the deadly poison ricin recently mailed to Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York City, and a leading force in the gun control debate were found to have similarities to a suspicious letter sent to President Obama. The letter sent to Obama, intercepted in a White House mail facility, is currently being tested for traces of ricin by the FBI. That letter had textual similarities to 2 letters to Bloomberg, postmarked from Shreveport, Louisiana, and sent to both his office in New York and his gun control advocacy group in Washington, D.C., known as Mayors Against Illegal Guns. New York's police commissioner said that all 3 letters appear to have been typed on the same computer and might contain the same text verbatim. The letters to Bloomberg, referencing the gun control debate, threaten that anyone who tries to take away the writer's guns will be shot in the face. Louisiana State Police's spokeswoman said that the Shreveport facility, from which the letters were postmarked, handles mails from Louisiana, Texas, and Arkansas, and that the exact origins of the letters were not yet known. The mail workers who initially handled the letters were unaffected, but three officers from New York have had mild symptoms that soon subsided. Other recent poison-laced letters include a 37-year-old who threatened to kill a judge in Washington State and a postmarked letter from Memphis, Tennessee, and traced back to Tupelo, Mississippi.
Last week, the hunger strike at Guantanamo Bay Prison prompted President Obama to again promise to make good on his 2008 presidential campaign promise to close the facility. A handful of the prisoners have been force-fed and hospitalized, with no sign the hunger strike will end anytime soon. Obama's plan has been to lift the moratorium, release many of the prisoners to Yemen, appoint a senior official to oversee the transfer, try many of the prisoners in a civilian court, and relocate tribunals to U.S. soil. However, Obama has not taken any formal action since last week's speech. Speaking on KABU on Wednesday night, local activist Brian Wilson explained his choice to hunger strike in solidarity with Guantanamo Bay inmates.
I was reading an account of how the actual force feeding works and how they were strapping these guys in their head, chest, midsection, feet, and arms. And then pushing this tube, an oversized tube, into their nose that makes their nose bleed and pushes it down into their stomach. It makes them throw up, even though they're trying to get what they're giving them, Ensure, E-N-S-U-R-E, this supplement. And I was seeing myself in that position. How could I handle that? And, by the way, force-feeding itself is in violation of international law. And so I went out in my garden at 3 in the morning. I couldn't quite sleep, and I just started crying thinking about it. Like, it was so evil, so medieval, so sadistic. So, in fact, these men have been there 11 years with no charges, no trials. Now they're keeping them alive through another element of torture. Force feeding is considered an aspect of torture. So I started crying, and I thought, what am I going to do? I can't just know that it's happening. I have to express myself in some fashion. So I decided the next